Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. This is the day we talk about new papers and presentations this past year in the management of lymphomas. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Andy Evans from the Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey and the Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Brunswick, New Jersey, where it's snowing pretty hard right now, and Dr. Sonali Smith, from the University of Chicago in Chicago. And actually, I was going to mention before we get started, you're both, you actually were working in, Andy, I guess you worked in Chicago before you moved to New Jersey. And I was showing Sony before we got started here, this is a cassette tape with Dr. Craig Jordan, your colleague, that we made in 1999. And guess what else? Cliff Huttis was also on this cassette tape for the newbies in the audience. That's the way we used to do things around here. But today we're here to talk about lymphoma and particularly what's been going on in the past year. And as we do in all of our programs in this series, I met with each of the faculty individually in the last week or so to record their presentation. The best way to use this series here is to watch the two programs where we go in detail through the papers, and then to watch the webinar where we try to put it all together and really try to integrate it with some of the questions in general that are out there in the management of lymphomas. Here are the papers that Sony covered, and she covered all of these papers in detail. This is a great way to review the literature. You can see a lot of stuff that we talked about. Same thing with Andy's review of Hodgkin lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell, lots of different papers. We're going to pick out a few of them and really try to get into, again, what this all means in terms of patient care. So we broke it down. We're going to talk about follicular mantle cell, which is covered by Sony first, then diffuse large B-cell and Hodgkin lymphoma. But just as a prelude to this, Andy, I wanted to get into the issue of, you know, now we're seeing CD3-based bispecifics, not only in hematologic cancers, and now we're starting to see solid tumors. There's a pretty cool drug in small cell that's a CD3 bispecific. We'll see if that comes into solid tumors. But also, of course, the issue of CAR-T. This is just a different magnitude and complexity of therapy, Andy. And I know you're both of you have been very involved in the whole issue of, you know, connections with the community. What are your thoughts, just briefly, I know you've both written about this a lot too, about how you see the therapies, T-cell directed therapies being integrated into the community oncology setting?
Neil, number one, thanks for the invitation. Great to be here with an amazing colleague and Dr. Smith. But you're right, it is getting more complex, but in a way, that's a good thing for the patient. And the reason I say that is with these targeted therapies, yes, they're effective, incredibly effective, but what can come along with that are some side effects or toxicities. And I think there's always been that collaboration of the academic medical center with the community oncologists. And I think, if anything, it might need to continue to evolve and become closer. And I don't even mean within our own networks. We have a 15-hospital center, but a lot of private practice docs giving great care who might, you know, 5% of their practice might be lymphoma. And if they have a relapse refractory follicular or large cell, A, how do you make the choice? So that initial decision making can be challenging. And then, of course, number two is safe and effective delivery of that therapy.
So, Sony, just to dive a little bit more into this, and we can get into this more as we talk about specific therapies, but I am curious how you see, you know, for example, bispecific, tenmosynituzumab, a very well-tolerated bispecific, be given in a community setting, theoretically. Do community-based oncologists have tocilizumab available? Do they need to have it available? What are the considerations as we start to think about bringing these agents into the community setting?
Yeah, I totally agree that, you know, having bispecifics in the community is a sea change and another way of harnessing immunotherapy. It's really important to have a plan ahead of time for how patients are going to get this therapy safely. And that requires a team, you know, that includes pharmacy, nursing, and the physician, having the tocilizumab on hand, educating the patient as to the signs and symptoms of cytokine release syndrome, and then knowing when to have that person come into the ER and educating your ER as the receiving end. So, you know, it takes a village, if you will, but I absolutely think this is feasible to be delivered in an outpatient setting and in a community setting if those pieces are in place.
So one other thing, Andy, and then we'll start going through some of these papers, is the issue of neurologic toxicity. We were talking about this before. I didn't even know that mosunetuzumab ever causes it, or, you know, the bispecifics. Sony was saying that, you know, they still would like to have, you know, a person at home with the person because of that. Any thoughts about how this is, again, going to move into this community setting and dealing with neurologic problems where the patient may not be aware there's a problem?
Yeah, thankfully, to your point, Neil, it's not common, but it's not zero. I mean, the severe neurotoxicity might be 1 or 2%, but you really can't predict who is at 1 or 2%. And God forbid they have it, they get on a highway and they're driving to an ER. So you have to, as we were saying beforehand, plan for the best, prepare for the worst. And meaning just if that uncommon rare situation happens, whether it's that or even severe CRS can be acutely debilitating, you want to have that planned. And initially, you know, I don't know, Sony, what you think, but we've seen it to be more earlier, you know, kind of the first or second cycles where you see that. Not to say you're 100% out of the woods beyond, but you're usually in a safer place after the first couple cycles.
So any thoughts? And also, I've heard for patients with lower grade CRS, I've heard some investigators say they give steroids to take home with the patient and tell them to take it without even coming in some situations.
Yeah, I absolutely believe the timing is important. So, you know, when we talk about having a caregiver, it's really the first cycle or perhaps going into the first or second doses of the second cycle. And then after that, it's really a well-tolerated treatment, you know, that people can go back and forth. I do think that having some dexamethasone on hand is helpful, but it doesn't mean that patients should dose themselves. I think this is one thing where they have to have a point of contact and say, I've had a fever now for over 12 hours. Should I take this? Should I go into the ER and let somebody else help them make that assessment?
Great. So we're going to try to, again, introduce a lot of practical issues as we go through these papers and see how a number of questions we've had for many years about lymphomas, how the papers that came out this year affected our answers. And Sonia, you went through the management of follicular lymphoma, and one of the things you talked about that I hadn't thought too much about was the issue of kind of establishing the prognosis of the patient up front, and that it's not that easy to do. And also the issue of POD24. I'm curious, when you see a patient relapse within 2 years, does it change your therapy? Are there trials out there? Any thoughts about these FL questions?
Yeah, I think despite everybody's best intentions, we are unfortunately left with really no precision approach for patients at the time of initial diagnosis. I do think that, you know, patients, their disease will declare itself. And so early progression of disease within 24 months or POD24 is progression of their follicular lymphoma within the first 2 years of their initial chemo immunotherapy. And we know that those patients have an inferior 5-year survival. That is, you know, about 50% compared to 90% for those patients who don't. The challenge is you cannot figure them out when they first, you know, are diagnosed with lymphoma, and it's really a time-based and an event-based outcome. But when they do have the progression, and I think this is important, it doesn't mean they need treatment right away. I think it's just a poor prognostic marker that when they do need treatment, they fall into that category. And if you look at all of our relapse refractory, you know, clinical trials that have been presented, there is a significant percent, in most cases, more than half the patients on those trials for relapse refractory disease had early POD.
So, Andy, a couple other questions about FL and whether anything came out this year that affects your kind of the way you look at this. And one issue I think that Sony mentioned when in her presentation is, and when I was asking her, we were talking about the fact that BR beat R-CHOP in indolent lymphomas, you know, whatever, 10 years ago, and why it did, and what your vision is for how bendamustine works, and particularly how it affects T-cell function. And now as we think about bringing T-cell therapy early and earlier, is that causing you any concerns? Sony reviewed some updates on data from obinutuzumab. Curious whether that is ever part of your regimen, follicular lymphoma. And, of course, it seems like the age-old question of rituximab maintenance, Andy.
Sure, yeah, all awesome questions. And we certainly have known even before bendamustine, T-cell fidelity is important. And even before CAR-T, what maybe we didn't appreciate, though, its impact until we started piling on a lot more treatments, such as obinutuzumab and bendamustine. And so we at least have to think about it. It's still my for high tumor burden, follicular lymphoma. In other words, a patient who needs treatment off study would be bendamustine rituximab if there's not a clinical trial. But you know, we have to be cognizant of that. There can be infections. We prophylax everyone for HSV, herpes simplex virus, and PCP on any bendamustine-based therapy. I don't currently give obinutuzumab up front, and it's like every treatment combo that comes along, it's assessing, well, does the efficacy outweigh any increased toxicity? Not to say it's incredible increase, but it is a little increased compared to BR, and so it just really for most patients hasn't broken through. In terms of maintenance, boy, I might be the academic outlier. I typically give maintenance. Now, it's slowed down in COVID for obvious reasons, but before COVID and now coming out of COVID, I admit there's no difference in overall survival, and I admit you could give rituximab single agent and get the same regimen, but you know, having a nice long first remission, and we know with BR or even R-CHOP, the median first remission is 10 years, with including maintenance therapy, and we've seen that in longer-term follow-up from the PRIMA trial, for example. So with that said, do I have a low bar not to give rituximab maintenance? Of course, if someone had hepatitis B virus, even with core antibody, I would not give it. If they have chronic infections or sinusitis, et cetera. So case by case, but those are some initial observations.
So I think that is maybe a little bit of an outlier for academia. We'll see what Sony says about when or if she uses maintenance after BR. Also in the chat room, Dr. Kumar asked the question I asked you when you were doing your talk. Mm-hmm. What's the definition of POD24? But he brings up an interesting thing. Is it just the appearance of disease or symptomatic relapse? And then here's two more questions in terms of second-line therapy, Sony.
Yeah, so the maintenance question, you know, I do not give maintenance in general, partly because of the lack of a survival advantage and the, you know, increased risk of infection, but also fatigue and the time in the doctor's chair. The other piece is that the 10-year median, you know, that you referred to really was with R-CHOP and not with bendamustine. And I think we could definitely discuss whether or not rituximab maintenance adds after BR, you know, to the same extent as it does after R-CHOP. The question in the chat about POD24, it was defined in the LymphoCare trial as from the initiation of chemoimmunotherapy. I will say that in some trial settings, it'll be a little bit more loose and say that the clock starts at the end of chemotherapy, sort of at your end of, you know, treatment sort of response assessment. And so there's a little bit of, you know, gray areas there. But it's defined as progression, for example, on a scan or clinical progression. It does not necessarily mean that they need treatment. So you could have an asymptomatic person with POD24, watch them for another year, and then, you know, give them whatever treatment they clinically need.
So I want to go on and also get your thoughts on T-cell therapy and follicular lymphoma. We're going to talk about it in all three of these lymphoma, particularly the use of CAR-T therapy. So I'm going to come back to Andy and say, how do you envision the global efficacy and tolerability of CAR-T therapy in FL? And what comes first, pretty much, CAR-T or bispecifics in FL? We'll get to diffuse large B-cell and mantle cell later.
And just one quick dovetail on the POD24. Neil, I just wanted to add that Sony's absolutely right that it is a definition. It doesn't mean you need treatment. With that said, in many of the studies, a third and in some half, that POD24 represents an actual transformation to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And so I think sometimes practitioners don't appreciate that, and not to say a PET scan diagnoses that, but we've seen some where the PET is 20/25 with a POD24. You should really biopsy and think about transformation. So just on all of that, just something to keep in the back of the mind. In terms of this immediate question, yes, of course it's going to be individualized. And I, to me, and this is just me, I think CAR T is a little harder to tolerate in the follicular lymphoma patient than maybe even the diffuse large B cell. Whether that's because in some cases they've had multiple treatments, which may have included bendamustine, is there something with the microenvironment, the niche, that's a little different on cell recovery? And so I think because of that, and generally we don't think it's curable, CAR T and follicular lymphoma, I would say more often than not, not every case, but usually bispecifics are, we think about that a little earlier than CAR T. But it's there's not been a comparative trial, so I think the jury's still out, and it's case by case.
So for those of you who are raking the leaves or more likely shoveling the snow and not watching this, let us let you know that we were also flipping through a whole bunch of slides that came out in the therapies. I just put up one with the press release that came out right before the ASH meeting of the increased incidence of T-cell lymphoma in patients getting CAR T, both BCMA as well as CD19. There's a paper that just came out a couple of days ago from the Penn Group, fantastic, like 35 pages reviewing their entire experience. I think they had one case of T-cell lymphoma, but really a great paper to go through. We want to talk also about bispecific antibodies in follicular lymphoma as well. And I'll come back to you, Sony, and these are the questions clinicians are asking. Again, curious what we learned this past year. First of all, about the efficacy and tolerability of bispecifics in general, but mosunetuzumab in particular. Sony, any thoughts? And can you discern differences between the bispecifics being used right now in follicular lymphoma in terms of efficacy, tolerability, convenience, et cetera?
Yeah, so I think the bispecifics as a class are, you know, very exciting. I think that beyond the first cycle, they're very well tolerated. If we talk about mosunetuzumab, which is the only one that's FDA approved and available today for people, the global efficacy is that most patients have about an 80%, or there's an 80% response rate and a 30 to 40% CR rate. The important piece here is to think about who was included in these trials. And in general, these are patients with follicular lymphoma who have had, you know, a median of three prior therapies, and many of them had had like 10 or 11. Most of them have refractory disease or double refractory disease to both rituximab and an alkylating agent. And so to have this kind of overall response rate and CR rate at that level, you know, for any agent, you know, and but with these bispecifics that are generally not they're not cytotoxic, I think is a really important step forward, you know, for follicular lymphoma as a class. The tolerability for mosunetuzumab is that once you get past that day 15, so, you know, there's a step up for all of these. It's like, you know, you start with a low dose, you ramp up, and there's pre-medications that are required, and then you settle onto a level, and then it's given once every 3 weeks. And mosunetuzumab is limited duration. So, you know, you start with 8 doses, response adapted, maximum of 17 doses, and then you're done. The other bispecifics, and, you know, all of them are against CD20 and CD3, have differences sometimes in their structure or their route of administration. So some of them have an attenuated Fc portion that increases persistence and duration of the drug. Epcoritamab is given sub-Q. You know, I think there's some structural differences that might affect the likelihood of cytokine release syndrome. And I would just say that right now, the advantages are hard to discern. The follow-up is short. I do hope that over time we get a better idea of efficacy and tolerability. But right now, it's just a little too early for me to say which one is potentially advantageous.
I was just flashing on the fact that we've done two-hour CME programs on each one of these lymphomas. So, yeah, we're moving kind of fast. But, you know, if you go back to Sony's presentation, she goes through all the papers and each one of the bispecifics. So you want the details? Right now, we're trying to give you more of the clinical bottom line, which brings us to mantle cell lymphoma. I would say ASH had a lot of great papers this year in mantle cell lymphoma. And in general, mantle cell really seems to be getting more and more interesting from my point of view over the last couple of years. So, Andy, here's a pretty simple question. today, right now, how are you thinking about first-line therapy of younger and older patients? There's a simple question we've had for quite a while. And what did we learn this year that puts you one way or the other? And then what are you thinking about when you see a patient who's got either P53 or blastoid MCL? Andy?
Yeah, tough ones. Starting it easy. So, yeah, I would say more and more over time, I and our group, we try to have some harmony within the group at recommendations, are moving to more and more of a triangle-based approach. In other words, BTK-based therapy without an autologous stem cell transplant. Are there some patients, a few and far between, you know, maybe like a 40-year-old weird situation who has somewhat high risk but not P53 mutated or blastoid? We might think of a historical induction and consolidative autologous transplant. Yes, but it's becoming less and less. So it really is frontline BTK-based therapy.
So, Sony, any thoughts? I was mentioning to you that the most interesting thing that happened to me this year in terms of mental, so I think the audience knows about it, is I spent a couple hours with Michael Wong from MD Anderson last summer, and that certainly opened my eyes to... You know, I was interested that Andy talked about a window-like approach, not a triangle-like approach, which maybe is what would have been said a year ago. But anyhow, I am fascinated, you know, by the use of BTK, particularly, and I think you talked about it when we went through this, Sony, the work looking at calibrutinib and zanubrutinib with anti-CD20 rituximab, for example, the window approach bringing in venetoclax and maybe chemotherapy. Where are you right now, Sony, and where do you think you're heading in terms of this question?
Yeah, our institution is still doing sort of aggressive induction followed by an auto transplant and maintenance rituximab, primarily because the durability has been so long. The triangle study, which introduced ibrutinib into the induction therapy and then challenged the role of transplant, is a really, really interesting one. And I think what we saw at ASH this year was, could there be other BTK-based induction that then would reduce the need for chemo or, you know, other types of aggressive consolidation? And, you know, this one that's being flashed up right now is like a perfect example of using, you know, a triplet, ibrutinib, rituximab, and venetoclax, and then, you know, continuing with treatment based on, you know, baseline risk factors. I think, you know, the reason our institution hasn't yet changed over 100% is that, one, the durability. Two, we're part of the intergroup trial that is looking at MRD evaluation of induction therapy and randomizing people to either transplant or no transplant. And I think, you know, that approach is an alternative way of trying to decide how to treat mantle cell going forward. So
Andy, one of the things that Dr. Wong said to me that struck me the most was that he likes in older patients, which traditionally patients have gotten BR, if he can get it, which usually he's able to, and he knows that not everybody else might be able to persuade an insurance company, he generally is using a acalabrutinib, rituximab, and he says Zanu would be fine. It's just he happened to use a acala. Any thoughts about that, Andy? Is that a strategy you ever use? You see that coming soon.
I do. I'm not sure I would mix in venetoclax yet. That data is interesting, but premature. We have to obviously see how all the randomized trials flesh out. But I do. I mean, it's. I think generally speaking, obviously has a different toxicity panel than BR. Obviously, BTKs are pretty well tolerated. They have known toxicities we know about in terms of AFib and potential bleeding. But with the newer generation BTKs, I think it's becoming more and more of an option, especially for P53 mutated or blastoid patients.
So and that leads into the issue of relapse disease and another BTK inhibitor, Sony, that came along, a non-covalent, of course, has been, you know, also we see this in CLL, so many analogies between mantle cell and CLL, but of course I'm talking about pirtobrutinib. I'm curious, Sony, how you're using pirtobrutinib, what your experience has been in terms of tolerability, the data and its clinical reputation is very good in terms of that. Are you using it as a bridge to CAR-T? And what about CAR-T, Sony? When are you thinking about it? Do you bridge patients who have significant bulk? How do you think through relapse disease nowadays, Sony?
Yeah. So pirtobrutinib, you know, is, I think, a really exciting agent in that by being a non-covalent inhibitor of BTK, it binds to a different area on the BTK protein that, you know, makes it active even when there is, let's say, a resistance mutation against the standard covalent BTK inhibitors. It also changes the shape of the BTK, and I think the fact that it has a longer half-life, you know, is an advantage, you know, against resistant clones evolving. So where pirtobrutinib, you know, fits into mantle cell lymphoma, I think, is a really excellent question. It can definitely be used as a bridge to CAR T if the patient does not have rapidly exploding, you know, type of disease. And, you know, speaking of CAR T, I do think CAR T is a very, very appropriate third line regimen for the appropriate patient with mantle cell lymphoma. You know, many patients at this point have already had an auto transplant. We don't generally do auto for relapsed mantle cell anyway. And by the time they're on their third line, you know, we know that mantle cell lymphoma, unlike follicular, has a really poor outcome. And this is where CAR T is appropriate. I wouldn't say it's, you know, I think we still need a little bit of longer follow-up. It's active, but for some people, you know, if CAR T doesn't work, they end up going to an allo transplant.
So, Andy, another issue, and of course this comes up in CLL all the time, is choice of BTK inhibitor. So in patients who go through sort of the traditional route, although it's not been around that long, a BR followed by BTK, how do you choose? I think a lot of people are struck between Zanu and Acala and CLL. It almost, I hear, kind of almost a coin flip, so to speak. How do you visualize it in mantle cell? Are the patients where you would prefer one versus the other?
Yeah, not so much, Neil. I think it is a little bit of a toss-up for me. I've been, obviously, acalabrutinib has been around a little bit longer than zanubrutinib. So sometimes that'll be the tiebreaker in many cases. Uncommonly, we've had patients with severe headache related to acalabrutinib, and sometimes we'll need to switch off for that reason. Or if I had a patient with a history of severe migraines or something like that, might be a reason to use Zanu. But I think they're markedly more similar than different in terms of efficacy and tolerability.
So, Sony, I'm curious about CAR T. One of the things I've heard, don't know exactly what the numbers indirectly are, is that you see more tolerability issues, more CRS, and maybe better responses than when CAR T's, I don't know, even maybe diffuse large B-cell, but I guess definitely follicular. What is the sort of general, you know, response and tolerability issues that come up with CAR T? What kind of patient, how old the patient has to be in order to not consider mm-hmm. CAR-T, even if they're in good conditions? Any general comments about CAR-T and mantle cell?
Yeah, I think CAR-T in general, we know much more about managing the toxicity now than we did when CAR-T first came around. And that helps us select patients a little bit better from a risk perspective. So patients with, you know, bulky disease, rapidly growing disease, progressive disease, and circulating lymphocytosis are more likely to have adverse effects. And so conversely, you can pick patients who don't have those features, you know, to be selected to move forward with CAR-T. The other piece is that, you know, we used to, especially when in the DLBCL setting, you know, CAR-T was first developed third line and beyond. And so we were kind of used to giving people salvage chemotherapy. And if it didn't work, you'd go on to CAR-T. Now what we know from that experience, but also I think for mantle cell and for follicular, is that the less heavily pretreated patients, especially those who have not had prior bendamustine, are more likely to do well. So it's kind of a little bit of cherry picking. The best patients do better. So,
yeah, well, that kind of makes some sense. Anything you want to say, Andy, about the mechanism of action of pirtobrutinib? You know, it's a non-covalent binder, and also sort of the pharmacology of the agent. Any other comments you want to add to Sony's comments about tolerability with, and also what we know about cardiac impact of pirtobrutinib, Andy?
I think Sony did a fantastic job of describing it, and it is a novel mechanism of action, not just binding it different, but the conformal changes that it makes, as she highlighted. I have found it incredibly well tolerated. And I think partly because of that, Neil, that, you know, in the intergroups, it's being thought of, could we use this frontline in a mantle cell lymphoma study? It hasn't been decided. It's being discussed. So I think that question is going to emerge. Of course, it makes sense because of its mechanism to use it after a classic BTK. But I think the next question is, should it be used as the initial BTK?
Sure, that is a very interesting question. I think at this point, I'm actually going to move forward and talk about diffuse large B-cell because there's so much to talk about there. And then we'll finish out with Hodgkin lymphoma, some really interesting stuff there as well. So just a little bit of follow-ups. We've been talking about this for a while now, Sony, the Polaric study using Pola-R-CHP. But Andy, when he reviewed this, brought up something. I mean, I've heard so many people comment on Polaric. I never heard the comment that Andy made. It just shocked me. And the question is,
not in a
if you're in
way,
the community.
Sony.
No, in a good way.
It,
you know?
It was a good.
So what he said was that the cell of origin, you know, because there's obviously this big, you know, debate about cell of origin. You know, we saw more data at ASH showing the great benefit ABC, no benefit or with GCB. But the thing that that he brought up to me is that the assays that a typical assay that a community-based oncologist is going to get on cell of origin is, according to Andy, not reliable. Mm-hmm. That there
not
are
as
false,
reliable,
you know,
as gene expression. Not as, it's about,
and that, you know, it's a different kind of assay that you all in academia are using. So beyond the theoretical argument of whether or not it's an appropriate subset, he also questioned whether or not we actually have an assay, particularly in the community, that's going to differentiate cell of origin. So I guess we could turn this into agree or disagree, Sony.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there is such a big difference between, you know, academics and community-based opportunities to look at cell of origin. I mean, what's standard of care is that you do immunohistochemistry. And if something is CD10 positive, it's germinal center. If it's CD10 negative with MUM1 in particular, it's non-germinal center. In terms of more sophisticated assays, whether it is NanoString or, you know, some other gene expression-based or genomic, you know, testing, none of that is standardized. So I would just argue that I don't think any of us really have routine ability to say what the cell of origin is. And the other piece is, I don't know exactly how important that might be. You know, the cell of origin was a clue as to the underlying heterogeneity, but we now know that genomics actually is probably more precise at identifying different biologic subgroups. So this is really an area that's in evolution in my mind.
Yeah, that was really what I learned. And really, I recommend that you all check out Andy's discussion because he goes through in a detail. There are other assays that are being used. One other very practical question, and Andy, you commented on a paper, I think it was from ASH, looking at our mini Polaric, so to speak, in older patients or patients with cardiac issues. Is that an approach, Andy, that given these new data is reasonable to use in clinical practice, or should people be sticking with our mini CHOP?
Well, number one, it had the best trial acronym known to man, the polar bear.
Right.
The polar bear.
Yeah,
who doesn't like
those.
A polar bear? So I
like GLOW. I like GLOW and CLL. That's one of my other favorites.
You got points on that. Yeah. But yeah, what's only been reported so far is the safety data. I'd like to see the efficacy data to make sure. So I think it's really interesting, a mini Pola-R-CHP. I haven't done it yet in practice because of that, so I've stuck to routine mini CHOP, but I'm excited to see that data.
You could also onto the S198 trial of our mini CHOP with or without oral azacitidine ongoing.
Wow, that's interesting. So tafasitamab, and particularly the L-MIND regimen of lenalidomide and tafasitamab and LONCA-T, the antibody-drug conjugate. In terms of tafa-len, after listening to Andy, it looks like as the data keep maturing, the responses keep looking better and longer, and safety looks good. Any comments, Sonia, and what's your experience with this regimen? Where do you see it heading? I've seen combinations adding to this regimen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Tafa-Len, you know, is approved for second line and beyond for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And in the original trial, those patients who achieved a complete response, the majority of whom were second line, not third line or beyond, the CR or the durability is really impressive. You know, remembering, again, this is large cell lymphoma we're talking about. So I do think that there is a group of patients where this is incredibly active, and it's being used as a backbone in an intergroup study, you know, adding either zanubrutinib or tazemetostat to this backbone. I think it's really well tolerated. The main, you know, challenges are with the lenalidomide, I think, you know, which can cause cytopenias. And, you know, we're all familiar with using that agent in different settings, but that is one of the side effects to think about. So in terms of how I use Tafa-Len, I use this for people who are not headed towards CAR-T, who are not interested in CAR-T, or, you know, don't have access to it. Certainly recommended this for patients when I've talked to referring physicians. And your last question here, will it become a standard part of first-line treatment? I think it makes a lot of sense to try it and to test it. You know, an anti-CD19 antibody that is enhanced, combine that with an anti-CD20, combined with chemotherapy. I certainly am excited to see what that data looks like.
So, Lanka-T, here are some of the tafasitamab data, looking at response rates, as we were just saying. And here's, you know, maybe Tafa-Len coming into first line, the first line a trial looking at R-CHOP plus Tafa-Len. We'll see where that heads. Andy, what about Lanka-T, the antibody-drug conjugate? What's your experience with it? I guess one of the issues from a clinical point of view is the effusions that come with that sometimes. How often do you see it? How much of a problem is it? And where does it stand in your, you know, algorithm in terms of sequencing, Andy?
Yeah, probably have a little less experience with it. I mean, mainly all of a sudden, as Sony knows, we have a potpourri of targeted agents available for us. So I can't say it's a certain line of treatment, but it usually, of course, is after initial relapse to our chemotherapy. Then you have CAR-T, then you have bispecifics. We just showed the tafasitamab. There's polatuzumab. And so maybe around that time, if someone didn't have access to those therapies or is progressing through those, I think this may surface up as an option. And obviously, assuming there's not a clinical trial for that patient.
So, Sony, a few questions from the chat room from Dr. Kumar again. With Tafa-Len, does a dose of Len need to be adjusted for renal dysfunction? Was that done in the study? Also, he has a patient who didn't want to take Polarix because he thought vincristine is better tolerated, I guess, in terms of peripheral neuropathy than Pola. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so for the lenalidomide, absolutely. You know, everything has to be adjusted for the clinical situation. So if the GFR is low, you have to start with a lower dose. If they have a baseline cytopenia because of marrow insufficiency, you should start with a lower dose. You can always escalate if it's tolerated. So, you know, that I think makes a lot of sense. And the second question you had about the Polarix trial and tolerability. So this was actually compared head-to-head. What was the incidence and severity of neuropathy in the two arms, and it turns out it was actually equivalent. There was no increased toxicity with polatuzumab vedotin over vincristine-based therapy. So I think we all were concerned about that. It makes a lot of sense, but it actually turned out not to be the case.
So, Dr. Kumar, you can play that comment from Sony for your patient. We have another question, curious, Andy, from Daniel. Elderly patient, double hit, diffuse large B-cell, not a candidate for dose-adjusted R-EPOC. What about Pola-R-CHIP or mini Pola-R-CHIP?
I think it's an option. Now, we reflect back, as we said, on the Germinal Center ABC data, but, you know, those are usually Germinal Center patients, those double hits, not always. I think that would be an option to consider. I mean, that's obviously a very tough patient population. Of course, would look for a clinical trial. You know, one of the studies we talked about was CAR-T in a frontline setting as consolidative therapy. But that's a very unmet need population right now. And even though I will often use dose-adjusted EPOC, That's in the absence of randomized data. I'm not even sure, I know that's not the best therapy, even though that's something we reach to. We need to find better treatments, and it's probably going to be vis-a-vis adding in targeted therapeutics.
So back to CAR T in terms of diffuse large B cell, Sony and Andy went through these papers that updated a lot of the key trials. But coming out of that, I was wondering, Sony, if you could just chat a little bit, because Andy in the talk went through kind of what the timing is of what happens to the patient who gets the CAR T at your center, and also where is outpatient CAR T heading, Sony? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think it's really important that as soon as somebody has relapsed or refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that they get referred, you know, as quickly as possible to a center if they are to be considered for CAR-T. One of the things we learned from the randomized trials in the second-line setting with DLBCL is that the need for more, bridging therapy reduced the general efficacy. And so the axi-cel trial had no bridging therapy allowed. The liso-cel trial allowed, I think, one or two lines, and then the T-cell one allowed, you know, at least or most patients got it. And we know that the T-cell study was a negative trial. So I think referring early or at least calling early is really, really important. It's also important for patients and providers to know that once a person is referred, there is a process that needs to happen. The patient has to be evaluated, make sure they're stable, they're appropriate. The T-cells have to be collected. Then there's a delay for manufacturing, which has been shortened. You know, in general, I would say that this is now, you know, within 2 weeks for axi-cel for sure. It's also, you know, relatively quick for liso-cel, and T-cell is also catching up. And then they get reinfused along with some lymphodepleting chemotherapy. So the timing of all of this, you know, good coordinators, they are, you know, the lifeblood of getting this done in an efficient way is really important. And you want to go to a center that is familiar with CAR-T, has a large volume of patients, and can help get patients through safely.
Just to follow up on that, Sony, I'm curious. Mm-hmm. We know that liso-cel is, you know, much better tolerated than axi-cel. I'm curious, you know, just more clinically, not so much when you look at the data, in terms of the type of patient that you feel, you know, you'd be comfortable referring for liso-cel versus axi-cel versus bispecific. I don't know, if you can give us mm-hmm. more of a feel for, you know, are mm-hmm. there patients that you would not want to see get axi-cel? You know, mm-hmm. for example, liso-cel, and then where does bispecifics and liso-cel fit in terms mm-hmm. of tolerability?
Mm-hmm. Those are a lot of questions right there, so I'll try. But, you know, the first one, you know, in terms of liso-cel, you know, this one appears to have the least amount of cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity of the products that are available, and it's approved for second line and third line, even in older patients. And, you know, it has sort of a more delayed, I would say, T-cell expansion. And so that might lend itself to patients who have a more slowly progressing disease. Axi-cel, the T-cells expand very quickly. And that might be why there is more of a cytokine release syndrome that is in the short term and maybe a little bit more toxicity. However, I think when it comes to efficacy, they're both very, very similar. And again, this is comparing totally different trials, totally, you know, maybe patients are, you know, there may be some subtle differences between the two. But I would say in general, our approach is more aggressive therapy needed quickly. We go with axi-cel if patients have a little bit more, you know, slowly progressive disease or are older or more frail, we go to liso-cel.
Bispecific antibodies. Andy reviewed some of the recent data that came out this year with a number of these agents, glofitamab, epcoramab, I got to learn how to pronounce that, odronextamab. Bottom line, Andy, first of all, and we already have two or three people in the chat room asking about sequencing CAR-T and bispecifics, but also does prior exposure of to CAR-T therapy impact the benefit that we see with the bispecific antibodies? Any comments, Andy?
Yeah, on the first one, I generally speaking, I think of CAR-T therapy before bispecific for relapse refractory CAR-T, especially for a first relapse primary refractory. And part of that is been around longer, and I have started to use the C word, cure, for patients who are out several years from CAR T. They likely are cured. I'm not sure we can say that yet with bispecific antibodies in relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell. It may be with more time we see that. I mean, obviously, it's a one-time treatment versus other. Of course, there are also patients who just for one reason or another, certain comorbidities, you can't use CAR T. And so that's the setting there. What was the second question, Neil? Can you go back?
Prior exposure or CAR T.
The efficacy is definitely lower when using it after CAR T versus CAR T naive. I don't think that's necessarily changing the biology. It probably is just a relapse refractory, very difficult case. There's not been a randomized study. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a randomized study. It would come out fairly equal. But generally speaking, yes, it is still active. This is important. And I'm sure Sonia has seen cases like this. I have two patients I saw last week. Both relapsed within 30 days. One patient relapsed within 2 weeks. And both are now in CRs after bispecific antibody after about 2 to 3 months. That's not the norm. The overall response rate in CAR T resistant or refractory is probably 50 to 60% with half of those being CR. But these are active in the CAR T resistant setting.
So, Sonia, as we were talking about with FL, you know, in the general medical oncology setting, we just have to ask these questions that don't have perfect scientific answers because we just want to know where you're at. And globally, we see, you know, it's hard for me to distinguish efficacy, tolerability, convenience. Take a shot at doing it for diffuse large B-cell bispecifics, Sonia.
Yeah, I think, you know, what Andy said is that if somebody does go for CAR T, then, and if I have the option of both, I typically go with CAR T first because I do think there is curative potential there for this particular disease and reserve bispecifics for, you know, the next line beyond that. However, you know, if you're in a community setting and CAR T is not feasible, or practical, you know, I first of all, we get patients from downstate Illinois where, you know, they have no car or they only have one child who could drive them and, you know, that person can't get off work or something like that. So, you know, it's a real issue. In that situation, I think bispecifics make a lot of sense because there are some durable responses, particularly if there is a CR as opposed to a PR. So I think it kind of comes back to picking the right patient for the right treatment. And it's not based on biology. It's based on logistics and patient preference. When I'm trying to look at the data right now, and, you know, Andy did a great job of presenting all of these, you know, I think that mosunetuzumab is probably the one associated with the fewest numbers of, you know, grade 3 cytokine release syndrome. You know, at least that's what the data shows. Glofitamab probably has more of cytokine release syndrome. But the question is, does this, you know, perhaps reflect better efficacy? You know, that's, again, something where the durability, you know, we just have to wait for a little bit longer data in my mind.
So I want to finish out with Hodgkin lymphoma and particularly to get Andy's thoughts as a leader in this field. But real quick, back to you, Sony. A couple of people have asked, Gian is the last one here. Does CAR T have a benefit in patients with CNS diffuse large B-cell?
Yeah, and Andy alluded to this. This does seem to cross the blood-brain barrier. So patients with secondary CNS lymphoma were inadvertently included in some of the early CAR T-cell trials and, you know, had a remarkable response. And so there are now trials going forward trying to specifically evaluate this patient. But having CNS disease is not a contraindication to going through CAR T. There is activity.
So Hodgkin lymphoma, and of course, at the last ASCO meeting, we got a great gift, the SWOG 1826 study, plenary presentation, really fantastic trial looking at Nevo AVD versus BV AVD, which had been the standard. I think everybody kind of knows the story. But what I wanted to get into a little bit here is stage 1 and 2, because in talking to Andy, he told me about a new study, and I really want you, I want to get the audience's take on this. We put a question actually for the audience that we're going to check out and get back to you about what they think about the study. But first, let's talk a little bit about 1826 and advanced stage disease. Why don't I start with you, Andy? What's your take? Put aside reimbursement. Would you like to use Nevo ABD right now? What situations would you hold off on that because of, you know, concerns using an IO, autoimmune, prior transplant? I don't know how often that happens, but I'm sure it does happen sometime. And also, what about Nevo AVD in older patients? Andy?
Yeah, and I think that it's a critical point, putting aside reimbursement, because it's not FDA approved yet for frontline. I would use it, and it really is the remarkable results that Alex Herrera presented at ASCO. Of course, we need to have longer follow-up. That was only at 1 year. But this was earlier presentation than we expected because the SWOG Data Safety Monitoring Committee, we weren't expecting such a big benefit at 1 year. And you see the hazard ratios on the slide you just showed, Neil, are remarkable for 1 year. Yes, we want to make sure that's durable. So maybe I'll just put one caveat is assuming or if that durability is the same as we see at 1 year, because not only would we say it's more effective, but I think generally better tolerated. Was there a little more thyroid? Yes. Was there a little more neutropenia? Yes. But growth factor was not mandated in the Nevo AVD arm. So I think that's just rapidly coming to the frontline setting. In terms of the second question, maybe if there was a patient, and this is true not just for this study, but really any checkpoint indication, severe autoimmune disorder, maybe a solid organ transplant. There really is a paucity of data where you're worried about over T-cell activation. I think it's harder for patients with mild autoimmune disorder. I think that's one that you might try a short trial. And the third point about older patients, Dr. Rutherford from Cornell presented an oral presentation right here at the last ASH that there was even more proclivity of activity of Nevo AVD over BV AVD in older patients, with the caveat that we did not do geriatric assessments, but my bet is this is likely mostly fit patients. In other words, patients who perform all ADLs and have a lower SIRS comorbidity score.
So, wanted to get your thoughts. This is, I guess, looking at the idea of replacing the vinblastine with BV and go with BV Nevo AD. And I don't know whether or not I've heard that might be a consideration for the next intergroup study. Andy, any thoughts about what is the next question? Is it going to be this regimen or something else? What are you thinking about at this point?
Well, I have to be careful not to share any state secrets, but that, right. As Sony knows, but that is one of the discussions. And I think you just showed some of the interesting preliminary data. That would be a sensible trial, that if we assume Nevo AVD is the next king of the hill, well, what about two targeted agents, A and B? It would make sense not to have double vincas. Let's replace the vinblastine. So I think that would make a lot of sense as a potential next study.
So I want to get into this study, fairly recent study that's been implemented, a phase 3 trial, the AHOD 2131 study in stage 1 and 2 disease, integrating BV and Nevo into the management of these patients. And I'll start out, before we even get started, we already have a comment from the chat room that a doc who's had two patients with IDDM from IOs, or diabetes from IOs, concerned about using an earlier stage disease. Just kind of keep that in your mind as we start talking about this trial, how you feel about using immunotherapy, which, although very well tolerated, as Dr. Kumar in the chat room points out, can be associated with, for example, diabetes. So I'm curious, first, let's just start out before we get into the trial right now, Sony. How do you think through management outside of trial stage 1 and 2 disease?
Yeah, in general, I've been following the UK rapid approach, which is PET adapted. and uses limited ABVD followed by, you know, hopefully no radiation if they've had a CR. However, we are part of the AHAD trial, and we were also part of a trial, you know, prior to this that really tried to replace the ABVD with, you know, Nevo and BV. And, you know, it's pretty early days, but I really believe that using ABVD is going to go away. I think it's going to be replaced by some of these novel agents that really are quite active. And, you know, the concern about diabetes and other, you know, emerging autoimmune conditions with the use of checkpoint inhibitors, particularly in pediatric patients, is a real one. I will say that at least at the one-year mark, and we saw this at ASH this past year, we saw the activity of Nevo AVD, which was superior to BV AVD, even in the pediatric population, the pediatric and the AYA population. So I think that the activity is such that maybe now we could start to cut back the chemo. The immunotoxicity, I think that's a complicated question. I would ask the person, you know, Dr. Kumar, probably those were, you know, patients who are also heavily pretreated, getting, you know, with solid tumors and maybe other comorbidities, and not necessarily your young, you know, patients as well. So I think it's a little complicated question. I'm hedging.
that's a really good point, though. So, Andy, you know, like I always wanted to do a Shark Tank and oncology series, and I still want to do it someday. But how about doing a little pitch for this study, AHOD 2131? I will tell you that the initial poll of the audience, only 7% of the audience feels very familiar with this study. So would you like to educate them and see if you can get them excited about participating?
Yeah, I'm a little biased, but I think it is a great study. And I'll say that for a number of reasons. Number one, a lot of thought went into this, literally years of planning. The leaders of the study, I want to make sure the audience doesn't get fooled by the AHOD acronym. COG is leading this study, but it includes, as you see by the symbols, all of the adult intergroup studies. Just like COG was a great participant in the SWOG 1826 study, it's fantastic that we're harmonizing in the United States, at least in early stage and advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma, the pediatric adult therapeutic recommendations. And so what's great about this is the standard of care arms, Neil, if you could go back to the study design, really follow a PET-based approach, as Sony alluded to. So if you look at the RER, which is rapid early response, meaning PET2 negative, the standard of care arm is chemotherapy 4 cycles. It actually follows an H10 strategy, or the RATHL, where you delete the bleomycin for unfavorable risk. It's where you have a lot of sites or a really high SED rate, et cetera. And in those studies, there are, yes, 2 cycles of Biocop for PET positive, bona fide PET positive. That's going to be less than 5% of patients, if that. So very few. The experimental arm, where the arm, and this is built as a superiority study, is regardless of favorable or unfavorable, and also regardless of rapid early or slow early, as you can see in arms B, D, F, and H, it's no more classic chemotherapy. It's BV nivolumab for 4 cycles. And so the hope is, if we come out in the other end of this study, is the standard of care would be only 2 cycles of chemotherapy for all patients with early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, regardless of favorable or unfavorable risk. And on the second slide, the last thing I'll just cap that off with, that is so important in a disease with ABVD that we know is curable, is that secondary endpoint. And this was a lot, and I'm going to give kudos to CTEP for allowing this, frankly, to follow patients out, because it costs money to keep a study open and follow for 12-year overall survival and post-acute and late effects. Because, yes, we want that initial cure, of course, number one, A. 1B, do so with less side effects down the road. So we'll be able to follow that. And not to mention in the last bullet, just a host of really important correlative studies looking at metabolic PET scan, ctDNA, of course, quality of life. So please, this is, you know, look at your local CTSU. It should be open. It's a pretty straightforward study to accrue to.
So
Neil,
I'm
how
really
did I
curious
do?
To see,
did I do okay?
You awesome. You said, right. Well, I was sold as soon as I saw the design of the study, to be honest with you, because my first thought was, I want my patient following the algorithm that you spent 3 years developing, not the algorithm I'm getting from reading up to date, et cetera. Sonia, I'll let you finish out in terms of, again, your thoughts about the study and, you know, the upside and downside of a doc in practice participating or a patient participating.
No, I'll echo everything Andy said. I think this is an incredibly important study that really works towards reducing chemotherapy for young patients who have, generally young patients with limited stage disease. I think we know that even if it does come back, we do have some good salvage options. And so if we can reduce the treatment up front for the majority of patients, we've done a great service. And I hope every patient with limited stage Hodgkin's, you know, will be considered for this trial.
Sonia and Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. Audience, thank you. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much. Sonia,
thank
thanks a lot, Andy.
Thanks so much.
Awesome.
This was fantastic.